Hello, and welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Well, last week I left you with our writer, Neil Shea, alone with a wolf. Indeed, that's the title of this particular article, Alone with Wolves. So clearly he lived to tell the tale, but let's see what happens in that close-up encounter with a wolf. I could hear gastric sounds, the wet squeeze of a roiling stomach. She looked me up and down, her nose ticking through the air as though she were sketching. Then she stepped nearer and suddenly pressed her nose to my elbow. It was electric, and I twitched. The wolf leaped away and trotted onward, unhurried, glancing over her shoulder as she joined the rest of her family, busy burying their faces in leftover muskox. It's tempting to think of wolves as we do dogs, companionable, limited, even cartoonish in their appetites or tendencies. Partly this is because they are visibly similar. Partly it's because the comparison puts us at ease in the presence of a creature that for ages has been mythologized as a heedless killer. My encounter with the Ellesmere wolves erased any lingering thoughts of dogs. The bright-eyed female had examined me methodically. Calmly. She barely broke eye contact, and I glimpsed a radiant intelligence far beyond anything I'd known in other animals. There was an unmistakable sense that, in the depths of our coding, we knew each other. I don't mean any sort of personal connection. She was not my spirit animal. I'm talking about genetic blueprinting, a species-level familiarity. Wolves are slightly older than modern humans, and so we were fully formed when Homo sapiens emerged. It is no great stretch to believe that in our youth we watched wolves hunt and learn from them, even while some became our pets. Wolves, like humans, are also one of the most successful and versatile predators on the planet, and they live in family groups that are, by some measures, more similar to human families than even those of our closest primate relatives are. As climate change transforms the Arctic into a warmer, less predictable frontier, wolves will probably adapt the way we would, by exploiting new advantages, and, if things go to hell, by migrating somewhere else. Shortly before I arrived on Ellesmere, the pack lost its mother. She had been maybe 5 or 6 years old, thin in the hips, slow to rise, and yet so firmly in charge that when my friends encountered her in August, they didn't notice her frailty. She was likely mother to every wolf in the pack except her mate, a slender male with a bright white coat. He was the group's lead hunter, but she was its center. There seemed no question about who led. The matriarch hadn't shown much interest in my friends and their cameras, though she allowed them intimately near her newborns, setting a tone that would carry over into the pack's tolerance toward me. The crew told me her final act, a week or so earlier, had been one of unexpected devotion. After several failed hunts, wolf hunts often do not succeed, the pack managed to drag down a muskox calf, weighing about 200 pounds. They hadn't eaten a large meal for a while, and the wolves gathered around, panting, exhausted, ravenous. But the matriarch stood beside the carcass and fended off her older children, allowing only the four pups to eat. The older wolves begged, whined, shimmied forward on their bellies, hoping for a mouthful. She held firm, snapping and growling, while the pups gorged, until their bellies swelled to the size of bowling balls. It was probably their first meal of fresh meat. Eventually, everyone was allowed into the feed. The animals stuffed themselves and fell into the wolf version of a food coma. At some point after that, the matriarch vanished. She never returned, and we never learned what became of her. By the time I sat alone with the pack, they were still in disarray. It wasn't clear who would lead or whether the family would hunt well together. Winter was just weeks away, the starving time. The young, bright-eyed female who'd nudged my elbow seemed eager to fill her mother's role, though she cared little for nurturing the pups. And during her first attempt at leading a hunt with the pack's elder male, she'd been flattened by a muskox. A few hundred yards away, I had watched as the big beast lowered its head and dug at her with its horns. I thought she'd been gored. Instead, she bounced up and skittered away, tail between her legs, and the hunt fell apart. I sat with the wolves by the pond for nearly 30 hours, unable to tear myself away, unwilling for it to end. Whatever decisions or stress the pack faced, it was a happy time. They played, napped, nuzzled. I tried to keep them at a distance, but the wolves routinely wandered over to inspect me. I could smell their awful breath, hear their awful farts. Their interest slowly faded, but it was so cold that every hour I was forced to stand and do a warm-up session of shadow boxing and jumping jacks. My flapping and panting always lured the wolves back. They would surround me, cock-eyed and curious, and they must have sensed I was nervous. At a certain point, I set up a tent a distance away to get a few hours of sleep. While I was off, melting ice to make drinking water, the one-eyed female approached and surgically slid open the tent. She hauled all of my possessions onto the barren ground, arranged them in a neat row, then ran off with my inflatable pillow. Eventually, the wolves lay down and the pups piled together in a downy mess. While they slept, I wandered. The migrant birds had flown south. Foxes and ravens were silent. Strands of muskox hair, shed during the summer and smelling sweet as fresh-cut grass, streamed across the plain. Here and there, ancient muskox skulls sank into the soil, the thick bone yellowed with lichen, the horns curling toward the sky. I felt like a trespasser drifting through the rooms of an empty house. Hours later, the pack awoke and gathered in their usual post-nap huddle, with lots of face-licking and tail-wagging. It went on like this for a while, love at the end of the earth, until the older wolves trotted off, heading west toward prime hunting ground, leaving the four pups alone with me. It seemed to confuse them and me. This was not necessarily trust, more like nonchalance. I was neither prey nor threat, but some third thing, and the older wolves understood this. I can't tell you which members of the family survived winter, or whether they learned to hunt together again. Odds are good they did, just as odds are poor that all the pups lived. After the last of the older wolves dropped out of sight that day, the pups decided to get up and lope after them. I followed, and soon all five of us were lost. We wandered for an hour, and then along some nameless ridge, the pups sat down and began to howl, their little voices tumbling over the rocks. Well, after that extraordinary story, so vividly told, I thought, let's move on to the October issue of National Geographic. This issue is called Last of Its Kind, What We Lose When an Animal Goes Extinct. And we see here a man with a looks to be a dying or dead rhino, and he's touching the face of the rhino reverently. So let's begin with the article, Vanishing, What We Lose When Animals Go Extinct. And I wanted to note that these photographs are by that wonderful photographer, Joel Sartori, who has photographed so many species so beautifully in that black box, a kind of technique that he has. The author of this is Elizabeth Colbert, who we also have heard quite a bit from in National Geographic. And in big letters, it starts, if we lived in an ordinary time, time here being understood in the long, unhurried sense of a geologic epoch, it would be nearly impossible to watch a species vanish. Such an event would occur too infrequently for a person to witness. In the case of mammals, the best-studied group of animals, the fossil record indicates that the background rate of extinction, the one that prevailed before humans entered the picture, is so low that over the course of a millennium, a single species should disappear. But, of course, we don't live in an ordinary time. Everywhere we look, species are winking out. Just in the past decade, two mammal species have gone extinct, a bat known as the Christmas Island pipistrelle and a rat, the Pramble Key Melomys. That's M-E-L-O-M-Y-S. Don't know how to pronounce that. The International Union for Conservation of Nature lists more than 200 mammal species and subspecies as critically endangered. In some cases, like the Sumatran rhino or the vaquita, a porpoise native to the Gulf of California, there are fewer than 100 individuals left. In others, like the Baiji, also known as the Yangtze River dolphin, the species, though not yet officially declared extinct, has probably died out. And unfortunately, what goes for mammals goes for just about every other animal group: reptiles, amphibians, fish, even insects. Extinction rates today are hundreds, perhaps thousands of times higher than the background rate. They're so high that scientists say we're on the brink of a mass extinction. The last mass extinction, which did in the dinosaurs some 66 million years ago, followed an asteroid impact. Today, the cause of extinction seems more diffuse. It's logging and poaching and introduced pathogens and climate change and overfishing and ocean acidification. But trace all these back and you find yourself face to face with the same culprit. The great naturalist E.O. Wilson has noted that humans are the first species in the history of life to become a geophysical force. Many scientists argue that we have entered a new geologic epoch, the Anthropocene, or Age of Man. This time around, in other words, the asteroid is us. What's lost when an animal goes extinct? One way to think of a species, be it of ape or of ant, is an answer to a puzzle: how to live on planet Earth. A species' genome is a sort of manual. When the species perishes, that manual is lost. We are, in this sense, plundering a library, the library of life. Instead of the Anthropocene, Wilson has dubbed the era we are entering the Eremozoic, the Age of Loneliness. Joel Sartori has been photographing animals for his photo arc project for 13 years. In an ever-growing number of cases, animals housed in zoos or special breeding facilities are among the last remaining members of their species. In some instances, they are the only members. Tuffy, a Rab's fringe-limbed tree frog from central Panama, lived at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. He became the last known of his kind when a fungal disease swept through his native habitat and a captive breeding program failed. Tuffy died in 2016, and it's likely the Rab's fringe-limbed tree frog is now extinct. Romeo, a Sehuencas freak water frog that lives at the Natural History Museum in Cochabamba, Bolivia, and we do have a picture of that in this issue, was likewise believed to be a sole survivor. Scientists created an online dating profile for him. It linked to a donation page, and the $25,000 raised helped fund expeditions in the eastern Andes, where the species was once abundant. Amazingly, the search has revealed five more Sehuencas water frogs, two males and three females. All were taken to Cochabamba. The one female mature enough to breed with Romeo was named Juliet. Whether she will prove a worthy mate and perpetuate the species, no one knows. Was the Rab's fringe-limbed tree frog beautiful? Not in the flashy way of, say, the Spix's macaw, which is believed to be extinct in the wild, or the G's golden langur, which is endangered. But with its expressive brown eyes and gangly limbs, it had its own kind of charm. Sartori treats all creatures, great and small, handsome and homely, with reverence. His photos capture what's singular and, I'd also like to say, soulful about every living thing. One of my favorite images of Joel's is of a Portula nodosa, or Niho tree snail, laying down a trail of slime. There used to be dozens of Portula species in the South Pacific, occupying different islands and different ecological niches. Much like Darwin's finches, they are the darlings of evolutionary biologists, living, slime-producing illustrations of the power of natural selection. The introduction of carnivorous snails from Florida drove nearly a third of the Portula species extinct. Several survived solely thanks to captive breeding programs. Precisely because extinction takes place so frequently now, it's possible to become inured to it. This desensitizing is what makes Sartori's images so crucial. They show us just how remarkable each species is that's being lost. We live in an extraordinary time. Perhaps by recognizing this, we can begin to imagine creating a different one, one that preserves, as much as is still possible, the wonderful diversity of life. And so I'd like to describe for you just a few of the animals that are seen pictured here. The first is the most arresting photograph, I think. This is in a white background, and it's a gray woolly monkey, or Lagothrix cana. And in parentheses is EN, which I'm sorry, I don't know what that means. And so we see a young, malnourished woolly monkey from Brazil. She was raised as a pet. When she was captured, her mother likely was killed. Environmental police rescued her, and she's been treated, but she'll need to live in captivity the rest of her life. I'm sure the EN, I get it now, was for endangered. This animal has the most soulful expression on her face. I can't really do it justice. She's called woolly for a good reason. Her coat is very thick. It's sort of a light brown, a bit reddish. And she has definitely that round monkey head with the with close ears on either side of her head. And her big brown eyes are peering up at us in a most appealing manner, is all that I can think of. And I mean appealing not just as beautiful, but as asking of us something, appealing to us, not just appealing for us to look at. And on the next page, we have several frogs and toads. We have Anderson's stubfoot toad, which has a coral belly, very beautiful toad. And we have Espada's marsupial frog. It's a rare tree frog from the eastern Andes of Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. Espada's is less vulnerable to the fungus that is killing off some toads, because it, unlike most frogs, it does not lay its eggs near water. The female hatches them in a pouch on her back, hence the name marsupial frog. I did not read about that fungus. It's called the chytrid, C-H-Y-T-R-I-D, maybe chytrid fungus. And it's that Anderson stubfoot toad, the population of that has declined more than 80% over the past decade, thanks to that fungus and also losing habitat to agriculture and urbanization. Another marsupial frog is the silver marsupial frog. Looks pretty green to me. Perhaps I'm missing something silvery about it. Habitat fragmentation and loss from agriculture and fire have hit this Ecuadorian mountain frog particularly hard. Then we have that Sehuencas water frog, which is just a goofy-looking frog. Perhaps it's because of the way this one was photographed, but we see it sort of, we see mostly belly, but then its front legs are flung out. It's because of the shape of its mouth, it looks as if it's smiling at us. And its eyes are variegated gold and black. Very, very beautiful. But the attitude of this frog is, here I am, world. It's kind of a hilarious little picture. For 10 years, this particular frog, this is Romeo that we read about, was thought to be the last of his kind. As we know, that 2018 expedition from Bolivia captured 5 more. So we'll see how Juliet and Romeo get along. I hope it's not tragic like the Shakespearean couple. Finally, we have a Tabasara robber frog. That chytrid fungus has nearly wiped the species out, but researchers are still reporting hearing it in Panamanian forests, so there is some hope for this frog. What's notable about this frog is its unusually large, bulging brown eyes. It's a sort of a reddish coral-colored frog with a yellow belly, but it has really large brown eyes, and again, the shape of its mouth looks like it's smiling at you. Quite a charming frog, I would have to say. We see pictures of the Moor gazelle. This species of the Dama gazelle was once widespread across the Western Sahara. Now there are fewer than 300 Damas combined in Mali, Chad, and Niger. Their range is broken up by grazing lands for livestock, and they're at risk from hunting. Reintroduction of captive-bred animals has had mixed success, so their main threat is fragmentation. Now, under the threat of habitat loss, we see several species of butterflies, among them the Atossa fritillary, a beautiful orange butterfly, and the Atala butterfly, sort of slate blue or teal blue wings with a bright reddish orange abdomen. That is from Florida and islands to the south. It was considered extinct in the mid-1900s, but now its host, a palm-like plant called Kunti, has been popular in ornamental gardens. So that butterfly is starting to rebound. Hooray. Then we have a well-known butterfly to us, the monarch. Some migratory monarchs depend on habitat in Mexico, the U.S., and Canada for their life cycle, which means conservation requires international cooperation. The milkweed their larvae eat is being lost to industrial farming and development. Illegal logging in Mexico threatens their winter range. So those of you who have a garden and haven't planted milkweed yet, get that milkweed into your garden next year. Save some monarchs. Next, we see the Shouse swallowtail butterfly. It's a Florida native, and it was down to as few as 4 individuals by 2012 due to habitat loss. Conservation has raised numbers to around 1,000, but continuing threats include hurricanes, insecticide use, and climate change. Next, we see the Florida leafwing butterfly. The only surviving population of this critically endangered species lives in the Everglades National Park. It's a beautiful burnt orange, very symmetrical butterfly. Let's just hope it can survive. And the sixth one on this page is a large butterfly called the Malayan tree nymph. Though not yet on the IUCN red list, this large butterfly has been the focus of Malaysian conservation efforts. They include programs to breed the insect as well as the rare plant the caterpillar feeds on. It's not a brightly colored butterfly, but the pattern on its taupe wings with black spots and coloration is absolutely gorgeous. Now here's an elephant, the Asian elephant, whose main threat is poaching. Early in the 20th century, perhaps 100,000 elephants roamed across Asia. Since then, their population likely has been cut in half. They're killed not just for their ivory tusks, but also for their meat and hides, and sometimes in retaliation for the damage they do to crops. Now, I don't know if you get confused, but I'm never sure whether I'm looking at an Asian or an African elephant. The Asian elephants are the ones with the smaller ears. The African elephants are the ones with the larger ones, if that helps you to distinguish. Here are animals whose main threat is deforestation. For tree-dwelling lemurs, there's no life without the forests or Madagascar, their only home. Yet the island nation has lost 80% of its trees to development, charcoal production, and slash-and-burn agriculture. Lemurs are squeezed into limited protected areas. 38 species are critically endangered. Fuel-efficient stoves are being introduced to encourage people to reduce wood use and protect forest habitat. So here we see the diademed sifaka. Females may only be fertile one day a year in this particular species, so this lemur's ability to rebuild fragmented populations is quite limited. And then we have the unusual sort of bare-faced aye-aye. Though rare, this lemur, the world's largest nocturnal primate at around 6 pounds, is still found across the island, but local lore holds that aye-ayes are bad luck, and they're often killed on sight. I think this particular animal, if you've never seen an aye-aye, it reminds me of something you might see in Lord of the Rings, the way it sort of creeps along the ground and the sort of naked face that then goes into tufts of hair, sort of like hair club for men at the beginning stages, I guess. And then the fur really thickens the farther back on the animal you go. And it has sort of droopy ears, a bit Yoda-like ears. Finally, we see the brown lemur. Those populations have dropped by a quarter since 1995, and they're expected to keep shrinking thanks to deforestation and hunting. I'd like to, in the time we have left, just go back to the very beginning of this article. There are several animals photographed. Among them, my very favorite animal on this earth, the red panda. So I just wanted to give you the names of some of these creatures for whom the biggest threat is humans. Habitat loss driven primarily by human expansion as we develop land for housing, agriculture, and commerce is the biggest threat facing most animal species, followed by hunting and fishing. Even when habitat is not lost entirely, it may be changed so much that animals cannot adapt. Fences fragment a grassland, or logging cuts through a forest, breaking up migration corridors. Pollution renders a river toxic. Pesticides kill widely and indiscriminately. To those local threats, one must increasingly add global ones, trade, which spreads disease and invasive species from place to place, and climate change, which eventually will affect every species on Earth, starting with the animals that live on cool mountaintops or depend on polar ice. All of these threats lead directly or indirectly back to humans and our expanding footprint. Most species face multiple threats. Some can adapt to us, others will vanish. And so I'd just like to read to you the names of these species. I won't try to describe all of them because we don't have time, but I just want you to hear their names. We have the Javan green magpie, the Nubian ibex, March's palm pit viper, the wrinkled hornbill, the Arctic fox, Horsfield's tarsier, the Niho tree snail, Gray's monitor, European eel, the lesser flamingo, the Pacific walrus, the silver rice rat, the red panda, the Dakota skipper, the humphead wrasse, the clouded leopard, the pinto abalone, the West African slender-mouthed crocodile, the American burying beetle, and the Sumatran orangutan. So with that, I need to leave you for the week, and I do hope you'll tune in again next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford, and I thank you for listening.